So good evening, everyone. And as I sit here, and as I've been thinking about what to talk about, I'm very much filled with two currents, two things. One is that I just came back yesterday from teaching the 9-10 day retreat I do every August in Boulder Creek, Vajrapani. And I love doing this retreat, and it's very nice to... It was a nice retreat, it felt like, for me, to be there. And some of the... You know, the feeling of being on retreat and some of the things that I taught during the retreat are still very much in my head. And earlier in the a few days ago, I thought, oh, I'll just go to IMC on Monday and talk about some of the things I talked about on the retreat. And that would have been great. But then I see that most of the IMC people who were at the retreat are here tonight. I assumed it would be safe to come and teach what I taught there because they wouldn't come so quickly. They would, you know, go home and decompress. And but as far as I could tell, they're all here except for one. And he's home babysitting for my kids. So I could be here. And the reason why he offered to babysit was that, and this is the other thing that's filled me, is that my wife had to suddenly leave yesterday because her mother was dying. She had went back to Boston. And as it turned out, she arrived a few hours too late, and her mother died last night. And so that's very much, you know, with me. And my kids were told this morning, and this evening after dinner we did a little ceremony on our living room floor with a candle and remembering their grandmother. And so these two currents are in me, and so it makes the topic of that I was going to talk about today a little bit more poignant, or a little bit different perspective on it than I had planned. And because what I wanted to talk about was mindfulness of thinking. And thinking is a big part of human life. And there's a certain perspective we often have on retreat or in meditation about thinking. And but you know, get a different perspective on thinking in the context of some of these big transitions that people can go through in their lives. And as I was thinking today about thinking, my thought is that the world of thinking, thoughting, is a pretty awesome world, pretty awesome phenomenon. And the word I use the word awesome choicefully, because awesome is kind of a multivalent word that kind of has the sense of being wonderful, something really wonderful. But awe also has, as you stated, I think, had a connotation also as something that was fearful. Something that was awful was, like we say in English, it was awful. You know, it comes from the same word, right? Awe, full of awe. So there's this kind of double side to the word awe-filled. And so the world of thinking has that quality. It's something that's really marvelous and wonderful and to be marveled at. And it's also something awful. It's something frightening. It's amazing the amount of suffering and damage that can come through the world of our thinking. So an important part of probably any spiritual life, but I think certainly a mindfulness life, is to have some handle on the whole domain of thinking, the world of thinking, and to be able to not just have some vague sense of how to practice mindfulness with it, but with time to develop some real familiarity with your thinking world, how thinking works for you, what goes on in your mind when you think, so that you can find some freedom from it, but also some wise appreciation of it and its usefulness of it and how it actually also enriches our life as well. Now, I know that different people think in different ways. So it's a little bit tricky to give a talk about thinking, I feel, because I probably will give very strong prominence to how I think. And I tend to think verbally, a lot of words. And some people think, for example, more in pictures, visually. And so there's a different way. But in Buddhism, we consider both thinking, whether it's visual or verbal. Some people, there's other ways in which I think, different ways in which we thinking mind works. I've met people for whom they know that they think. They've been kind of intellectually, logically, they know that they think. But they have absolutely no clue how to turn their attention to be aware that they're thinking while they're thinking. They scratch their head, they hear the instructions and being mindful of their thoughts, and they don't have a clue what that means, you know. How do you do that? I mean, so somehow their thinking is compartmentalized or in some kind of back corner or somehow very shy or somehow very slippery. And as soon as you try to look at it, it just scoots off. And I'm not going to show myself to you. And so thinking goes along merrily, you know, as long as it's unattended. It's kind of like the parents. As long as the parents are at home, then, they can have a great time. But as soon as the parent shows up, then they disappear. There's different ways in which different experiences that people have of thinking. Also, the voice that we think with, if people think verbally, the inner voice, for some people it's completely a neutral kind of thing. It's just words somehow. But for some people, the inner voice is a voice and has many of the same qualities that a voice would have. If you listen to someone else speaking, you would hear some of those qualities. You hear qualities, for example, of the tone of the voice, the energy behind their voice. You know, they're soft-spoken, are they very loud? Are they gentle? Are they harsh? Are they hesitant in how they speak? Or are they kind of very aggressive and assertive? Is it fast or is it slow? You can listen to the quality of the inner voice and you can hear these different things. And over time, the quality of the inner voice can change and shift. Some people will report that certain voices they have, or maybe their general voice they use, or certain voices are the voice of someone they knew, like a parent. I know people who sometimes have very harsh criticism, and the critic voice inside of them is perhaps they internalize the parent, a harsh father or something, and when they hear the inner critics kind of being harsh, they can almost hear that their father's voice, for example, or a school teacher or someone that made a big impact. So, in that it's kind of like an inner voice, in that quality of a voice, just like a speaking voice is influenced by many things. So the inner voice is influenced by many things as well. I think that we all have our voice, the way we speak, and I listen to many people who speak, and it's very curious to me to listen to people who they speak, because you can hear sometimes generational ways of speaking. You can hear that, oh, that belongs to a certain time. I have a friend who's 92 years old, and he was professionally he spoke on the radio. I don't know, he had a radio show, a variety of radio shows. He wrote for the radio in the 40s, 1940s and so. And there's a certain way that these people spoke back then that you could hear in the old radio shows and the old television shows. And he still has that voice a little bit when he speaks. It's quite, you know, it's quite interesting. And so you hear, you can hear people from different locations, within the United States, outside the United States, you can hear things in their voice. So much goes on in the voice. The voice is not a neutral thing. Though, of course, my voice is, of course. Everybody thinks their own voice is neutral, right? No one has a dialect. Everybody else has everyone else is peculiar. But everyone has something, has a way of speaking. So you might be in a place where everyone speaks kind of like you, but then you go someplace else and they say, oh. I was born in Norway. I didn't grow up much there, but whenever I went back, I mostly stayed with my father's parents. And they kind of, my Norwegian I speak, it kind of comes out of their household. And it turns out, I didn't realize this, and when I went back to Norway, when I was, I didn't realize what kind of Norwegian they spoke. until I went back to Norway when I was about 20, and I was this long-haired hippie. I was living in communes in Norway, and with other hippies, Norwegian hippies. And they would listen to me speak Norwegian, and they'd laugh. Because I didn't know this until they told me, that the particular way of speaking, kind of the particular niche or place that my grandparents came from, they spoke the equivalent, they're kind of a little bit, I don't know if aristocratic is the right word, but a little bit upper class, and they spoke kind of Norwegian equivalent of the Queen's English. And, so imagine a hippie showing up at your commune and speaking very properly like the Queen of England. So they would laugh at me, and I didn't have a clue. I just was talking. And I've known people who have spoken more or less fluently different languages, and they have a different voice, almost a different personality, depending on the language they speak. Not everyone does this, of course, but we internalize much more with language and words. We often internalize a way of being, a cultural way of being. And so, again, back in Norway, one of the hippie communes I lived on, there was a Norwegian who I was very fond of, a good friend of mine. And English was one of the primary languages in this one commune I stayed in Norway. And so when he spoke English, my friend, he'd learned his English in the 60s, 1967 or so. He'd spent some time living in communes in America, in California. And so he had the hippie language down really well. That's what he learned, how he learned English. And he was one kind of person in English. But he had learned it. His Norwegian, he came from Oslo, and his Norwegian was also kind of, it was kind of like, I don't know what exactly to say, but kind of a very proper, conservative, not Queen's English kind of type Norwegian, but kind of very conservative, proper, uptight. And I didn't really like him when he spoke Norwegian. He was my good friend, right, in English. But there was something about something again internalized in the voice that's more than just, they're just words. So when we practice mindfulness of thinking, it's possible to tune in to much more than the words of what we speak. And in fact, the world of thinking is a very rich world because there are these tentacles, so these connections with the words that we speak in our mind, the image that we see in our mind, and so much of our human life. There's tentacles that go out to our emotional life, and tentacles that go out to our, obviously to our cognitive life, world of our beliefs. Beliefs that are not just conscious beliefs, but beliefs that are deeply conditioned, seemingly subconscious, that we carry with us. There's tentacles in our thinking that goes down into our physical body, and how we think affects our body. It affects, where we hold our tension, how we hold ourselves. Different kinds of thought and thought patterns affect our body different ways. Chronic ways of thinking a certain way. If you think a certain way all the time, it's going to affect your body in a kind of lasting way. When I get afraid or nervous, it affects my shoulders. And if I stayed, if I didn't meditate, boy, I wonder what my body would be like. But, meditation is a way of kind of letting go, unwinding some of the things that build up in the body. And I can see the connection between my thinking and what goes on in my body. I have a connection. There's tentacles that go down to my belly, my stomach. Tentacles that go into the chest, the heart. Tentacles that connect to the shoulders, to the jaws, to the neck, to the back, muscles in the back rib cage, to the eyes, to the forehead, to the temples, to, inside the skull. I feel sensations there depending on what's going on with my thinking. So there's physical sensations, the kind of tentacles goes on into the body. There's also tentacles that go into what we might call the energy system of our body, the energetics of our body. And so how we think can affect the energy in our body. And probably most of you have had some, especially if you meditate, but had experience of sitting quietly and minding your own business and being calm perhaps. And then some memory or some thought comes up. Someone who slighted you or, did you an injustice, perhaps, is a good one. Or perhaps you have some beautiful, you're reminded of someone who you have tremendous sexual lust for. know, just this, you know, that person's name pops up in your mind. And either of those kinds of situations, suddenly the energy kind of just changes in your body. And you can, you know, your mind gallops off on those thoughts, gallops off on injustice thoughts. You're angry, oh, how could that person done that? And, oh, and this ties to all the other people who have caused me injustice. And pretty soon, you know, there's energy in our system is really energized. So same thing with lust. You know, pretty soon you're really energized. And so you can see the energy changing in your body depending on what you're thinking. Now, it's interesting to realize the tentacles or the connectedness that thinking has to so many other aspects of our human life, because there's a feedback loop between them. And so if our body is a certain way, our emotions are a certain way, our energy is a certain way, it then also affects the way we think. And the question is, what comes first? Chicken or egg kind of thing. And I think it's a wonderful kind of interplay between them, where sometimes how the body is or how emotional life is affects the kind of thoughts we have. Sometimes the thoughts we have affects our emotions and our body and the energetics. And this is important to realize because a good percentage of our suffering can be traced back to our thinking, how we think. Now, it's possible to trace suffering to other things, but I think that if it doesn't trace back to our thinking, thinking becomes, for many people, some people, the medium through which the channels of suffering get expressed or get actualized or felt. So if we want to become free of our suffering, get a handle on our suffering, it helps a lot if we can get a handle on our thinking. And so it takes some time to look at our thoughts and understand what's happening there. The advantage of it, of learning about thinking, is that then also we can appreciate when thinking is not causing us suffering, but adds to the richness of our life. And it does sometimes. The depth quality of our life. I think some of the depth quality of our life comes through through the vehicle of our thoughts, the thoughts that carry our memories of past, our ideas of the future, the thoughts that can make cognitive connections, understanding of what's going on here. If we did stop thinking entirely and kind of dwelt in an empty mind that had no thoughts, except maybe in response to things, I think that our life would not be as rich. So there's a place for thoughts. So the reason I'm saying this is thinking about today, about my mother-in-law dying. It's so much goes on in that kind of transition in the family life. Just my wife, for example, I talked to her this evening. She's back in Boston. And she said that, they went to the funeral this afternoon. And they came back and the immediate family kind of hung around the house. And it's the first time she's really been home in her family house where she grew up. And her mother hasn't been there. And her father, is mourning. And she said, it was my turn to step into my mother's shoes, and I was the one who had to kind of make the food my mother used to make and, care for people in the house. That was kind of somehow. And it was very poignant for her to feel that. That poignancy of that transition, transmission from one generation to the next of someone, moving into the next generation, their role. She could have just kind of gone into the kitchen and started cooking, matter-of-factly, and with an empty mind, and this is just food, and people are hungry, I'm making food, and been very matter-of-fact about that. But there might have been some freedom in that kind of simplicity of attitude towards the food and the cooking, just food and cooking and all that. But the depth of her life, of my wife's life, had a lot to do with the memory and the context and the story that has to do with what's happening today in the kitchen, in the house. So we carry lots of memories, and so they add to our depth. They also add to our suffering at times, of course. And this is delicate thing. We have to be able to tease apart the wisdom, the depth that thinking can provide us with the suffering that can provide us. And because thinking can provide suffering, we have to learn to have a new relationship with thinking, where we learn not to get caught by our thoughts. And even depth thoughts, even thoughts that are wise and appropriate to have, it's possible to be caught by them. And thereby, anytime you're caught by your thoughts, there is some quality of suffering in that thinking. And some thoughts, you know, are innocent, but they're suffering because we're caught by them. Some thoughts are beautiful, but we're caught by them and so they're suffering. Some thoughts are suffering in and of themselves, the terrible thoughts to be had. And so they're suffering in and of the thoughts themselves. So part of mindfulness practice is to look at thinking and not so much look at the content of our thoughts, but to be able to develop, be able to see what goes on when we think. What goes on besides the content of our thinking. And so there are times in mindfulness practice then that the mindfulness practitioner would turn the attention and study thinking, look at thinking. What's going on here with my thinking? What's this phenomena? What's the phenomena of thinking? And it helps to think of, to realize that thinking is a composite. It's a composite. It's a collection of different factors coming together. So it's not just words. There's emotions, there's energy, there's body, there's intention, there's history. There's many things going on there. And so as you look at the process of thinking, to begin teasing apart these things. And some people might actually like to do it systematically. People who like to be systematic thinkers could do this systematically. They could actually say, okay, I'm thinking, I'm caught in a big bout of thought. Let's look at the, you know, first, let's look at the body. What's going on with the body when I'm thinking? I'm tense, I'm hot, you know, what's going on? And what's going on with my emotions? What emotions are connected to this train of thinking? And there's a whole slew of them that, you know, many regular kind of progression, any kind of ongoing train of thinking, or a theme of thinking, probably has some emotion connected to it, a mood or something. So what's the emotion? What's the energetics connected to it? What's the tone of the inner voice connected to it? What's the sense of tension or pressure or stress that somehow is in this psychophysical system that's connected to this thinking? So you can start kind of taking it apart and looking at these different elements. And then also you can look at it cognitively. What's the beliefs that are behind? What are the assumptions behind this what I'm thinking? Some people find tremendous freedom from simply asking the question, upon what authority do I believe this? You know, a lot of things you believe are probably be found to be on quicksand at the best in terms of the authority by which you believe something. I've heard some religious scholars say, warn people, say, don't look at your religion too carefully. Start questioning the authority upon which your religion is based. You end up very quickly on shaky grounds. So that's good. That's interesting. So in Buddhism, of course, we're not worried about that because, you know, if your religion, your Buddhism is based on shaky authority, sooner you can realize that, the better. You know, and sooner you can get that out of your system, the better. That kind of shaky kind of thing. So you can start, you know, you can ask a question of what authority do I believe this? And or what is the beliefs that are behind this? What are the assumptions? An interesting question to ask is, what is the sense of self? What's the self-identity, my assumptions about who I am, how I represent myself, how I think people see me? What's the sense of self that is tied to this train of thinking? And this is, of course, very interesting because, as some of you have done my intro class know, I like to say, or I like to teach that, you know, it's amazing. It's awesome. Awful. How repetitive our thinking can be. At least mine can be. Probably some of you also. You know, you can think the same thing 3 or 4 times, right? 10 or 20 times? 50 or 100 times? 500 times? You know, it's just slight variations, you know, of how you're going to plan something, or how many slight variations in how you rehearse the conversation or remember the conversation or the event or whatever. But just thinking it over and over and over again. And, you know, if someone walked next to us as much as, you know, and talked to us as incessantly and as, you know, repetitively as we talk to ourselves, we would think they were crazy. We would ask them to, you know, we probably want them institutionalized, or, you know, lithium would be good for them or something. And, you know, please. And We'd bribe them to try to be quiet. Anything. But when we talk to ourselves so repetitively, the amazing thing to me is unless you're on retreat, it's seldom that people get bored. You know, it stays just as interesting, you know, the 500th time as the first time. And now part of the reason I suspect for that lack of boredom is because it's often about ourselves. More often than not, I believe for most people, thinking centers around ourself, self-concept. So we can look, what's the self-concept that's connected to this thinking? Something as innocent as going out, you know, sitting in meditation and planning what you're going to have for dinner. Now, what is that? That has nothing to do with self, right? Just planning for dinner. Well, maybe people are coming over for dinner. You have guests. And so now, what you cook relates to how they see you. And so you want them to see you well. They want to see that you're a great cook, capable cook. So you have to kind of figure out what to buy that would make a good meal that would impress your friends that you're a great cook. So you can prove to them you are a great cook. So it isn't so innocent anymore. There's some self connected to this idea. So there's physical aspects, there's emotional, there's energetic, there's cognitive. The cognitive world is big because it also connects to our sense of self and our beliefs and our assumptions. So it's possible to look at all this. Now it's possible to look at all this and get a headache. And some of you are probably getting headache already hearing all this, how complicated it can be. Because, it's, you know, once you have so much complexity to something, you know, then the mind starts spinning out and wondering and, you know, and thinking even more. You know, Gil told us to look at our thoughts, and he gave us so much material to look at that now I'm just really spinning out. But the idea with mindfulness meditation is to look at our thoughts so we can get to be free. Free in relationship to them. And that means many different things. When something deep is going on in our life, like someone has died recently in our life, to have someone say, just let go of your thoughts, is not appropriate. It's disrespectful. You don't tell someone who's mourning the death of their mother, just let go of your thoughts. You know, what's this about, you know, first time in your life kind of being in the kitchen where your mother was and cooking for your family like she did, you know, the day of her funeral? It's just thoughts. Let go. Now, if you listen to me teach sometimes, perhaps, or other Vipassana teachers, especially if you hear us teach on retreat, and you generalize from our particular instructions there, you might think that's the point. That's what you're supposed to do all the time. Just let go, and live a kind of then a flat life. I think that we have to have the wisdom to know that sometimes it's actually part of our important part of human life to think and let those ideas and things flow and go. And how mindfulness practice can serve us there is can help us get out of our way so we don't interrupt it, so we don't stop it, we don't inhibit it, we don't judge it, but let the inner life kind of move and do what it has to do to add that depth to our life. And then other times, like if you are on retreat, or maybe you are meditating, that's the time, that's a particular time where it's maybe most useful to have an attitude, I just let go of all this stuff. Let go. Even then, maybe your mother died today. Maybe if you sit down to meditate, maybe that's a time to let all the feelings and thoughts just be there freely, perhaps. Or you might decide this is the time to just let go. And one of the reasons why to let go, and in times of great transition like this, is that sometimes the surface chatter of our mind is not so, it's not very deep. It doesn't allow for some deep processing to go on. So if you can let go of the surface chatter of your mind, then it allows for some deeper movement to start happening, some deeper connection to ourselves to happen. So maybe it's useful sometimes to drop things away. I think it's amazing, amazingly off-field things, how much superficial chatter can go on in my mind. Probably none of yours. I don't want to assume, all of you, that you're all like me this way. But it's amazing to me. I mean, sometimes it just seems to be random, silly kind of things goes through my mind. I could sit down with tremendous intention to meditate. Meditation is a big part of my life. I put tremendous value in it. the purpose and the ultimate goal of meditation. Liberation is an important goal for me in my life. I can sit down and feel the weight and the gravity, the gravitas of my meditation, my intention. I'm going to sit here and really do this practice. I'm so glad I finally get to sit down. 30 seconds into the sitting, and I'm thinking about pizza. What happened? Hey, what's going on here? Who's in charge? That's an interesting question, right? Who's in charge of your mind? So you know, you have different choices with your thoughts. And sometimes you can let go of it. Sometimes you use the mindfulness practice to help you let go, and perhaps drop into a deeper place. Sometimes you use your mindfulness practice to actually not let go, but just let go of everything but thinking. Just let your thinking flow and let it kind of fill your life and see where it takes you and what's going on. So you know, I think it's a common instruction in meditation is when you notice your thinking, let go of your thoughts and come back to the breath. It's a common instruction. So that's an interesting practice or movement in the mind to look at and understand. What do you do when you meditate? When you notice you're in your thoughts? What happens to you then? And what you learn at that moment might be very helpful for you in other areas of your life besides just that meditation. So what happens to you when you're happily following your breath, you're trying to be with your breath, and then you realize that for the last 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you have no idea what's going on with your breath because you're lost in some wonderful world of thinking. So what happens? Now I know there's some people, what happens is they get upset. I just blew it. This is terrible. I'm doing the wrong thing. This is unspiritual. I'm an embarrassment to Buddhism. I should better hope no one noticed. And I get back to that breath as quickly as I can, be dutiful and obedient, and try to please Buddhism. As if Buddhism could care less. So that's one attitude. Another attitude is, could I be connected to that, is kind of harshness. There's that jerking the mind back approach. You notice the mind is wandering off in the thought, and you jerk the mind back. Come back here, you. And get back on that breath. Kind of the drill sergeant approach. And then there's the pouncing approach, where you realize you're off thinking, and so you pounce back on the breath. That's another approach. Another approach is despair. Oh no, this is hopeless. I wandered off my thought one more time. Oh, this, you know, I can't do this. Or there is, discouragement. Or there is another approach is, this is a really interesting thing to think about. This is juicy. This meditation stuff, I'm not so sure about it after all. Or I believe in it, it's good stuff, but I've been struggling for a long time. I deserve to have a good time right now. And this is a really good, juicy thought, so I'm going to go off in there. You know, that's another approach some people have sometimes. You know, I'll do it later, the later approach. I'll get back to meditation later. Then maybe I've covered this already, but there's also the judging approach. As soon as there's a thought arisen, you notice it. It's followed immediately by some kind of judgment about that. That was a bad thought. That was a good thought. I'm a bad person because I'm meditating, but I'm thinking. There's all this judgment goes on. So what's helpful to do in meditation is to become aware of how you are. What happens to you when you notice that you've drifted off into thought? Even before you bring your mind back to the breath, before you do anything else, what happens in you? What's your reaction, response to that? Because if you can see your response and see it clearly, then you might be able to question that response. You might be able to stop believing the response. And you might actually be able to choose different responses. Choose wiser, better responses. In meditation, generally, it's not valuable, useful to judge yourself when you negatively or positively when you drift off in thought. It's usually not, it has no value at all, as far as I can tell, to it has very little value to judge good or bad the kind of thinking you have. Generally, in meditation, it's just you don't get interested in the content, generally. And just come back to the breath. Be very spacious about it. And one approach, the spacious quality about noticing the fact that you're thinking, is this amazing thing that happens. So, I'm sitting following my breath, happy with my breath, breathing in, breathing out, this is great, I got it, I'm on track, I don't think I'll leave it, this is going to be a good meditation session. I managed to do 3 breaths now. Yes, this is it, I'm sure I can do it. I think I should go on a retreat. You know, I think that I have some ability to meditate. A retreat would be really good. I wonder which retreat I should go on. I should get, you know, as soon as I get home tonight, I should get on the computer and Google Vipassana retreats and see what comes up. And then I can really do this, because I can really follow my breath really well. My breath. Uh-oh, I'm thinking. I'm thinking about how great I am at watching my breath. Anyway, suddenly you notice you're thinking. At that moment that you notice you're thinking, one approach is to say, uh-oh, that's bad, problem. However, before the judgment arises, something had to happen before there could be a judgment or a reaction to it. It happens maybe in a flash, so it's really quick. But there has to be a very simple, unjudgmental awareness, knowing, I am thinking right now. I've been caught up in thinking. And there has to be there. If you follow, so you notice you're thinking, if you follow that by saying, oh, I can't do this practice, this is too hard for me to be mindful, it's ironic. Because in order to know that you were thinking, you had to be mindful. And it's simply not true that you can't do this practice. Because you had to be able to do this practice to notice you were thinking. Maybe, but it was a flash. And it's possible to kind of begin appreciating that there is always going to be this flash of simple awareness, oh, I'm thinking, that precedes the judgment. And then if you can start noticing that flash, then can you just kind of extend the flash so it becomes a longer and longer period? Can you notice the perhaps sometimes the peaceful quality, the easeful quality, the simplicity, the transparent quality, the free quality, liberating quality of that initial moment of awareness that was without any self-consciousness? That's part of the beauty of it. There was a moment of awareness of thinking that was not self-conscious. And then we follow our self-conscious ideas. Oh, I have to practice now. I have to do all this stuff. Catching ourselves, it's kind of amazing to me. This is the amazing thing about the world of thinking. So much amazing stuff. If you're lost in thought, it's not a problem. You don't have a problem. Maybe other people do with you. But if you're lost in thought, there's no problem because you're lost. Right? You're not there. You're lost in your thoughts. How can you have a problem if you're lost in your thoughts? You're not there to notice. If you have a problem, you're there to notice. So, if you're lost in your thought, you have no problems. If you know that you were lost in your thoughts, no problem, because now you're mindful. So in relationship to thinking, you'll never have any problems. You're either checked out, in which case you don't have a problem, or you're aware you're thinking, in which case you're aware, you're mindful. Now, because of this, all these tentacles that go on, it's seldom that we leave it to be so simple. It's like then on the heels of noticing we're thinking, then we think some more. And we think judgmentally, we think this way and that way, our beliefs, our emotions, what goes on in the body, all this feedback comes back into how we think about our thinking. So don't despair. What you need to do is just slowly, patiently, and I think it'll happen to many of you just over time if you do mindfulness practice, you'll slowly, slowly become aware of the world, the ecology, the ecosystem, the related to your thinking, all the different aspects of it. And as you do that and become more and more familiar with the world, the ecosystem of your thinking, you'll find it easier and easier to let go. Do not be caught by them. To set yourself free from it. Either to let go of your thoughts and not have them there, or see thinking as being something that you can have a radically different relationship to, where you're not connected or lost or entangled with the thinking, but rather you're really free from it. The thinking can come up, exist, float away. You can think whatever, mind can think whatever it wants, but you are not entangled with it. There's no stickiness, there's no Velcro. There's no Velcro between you and the thinking. And if there's no Velcro, there's no suffering. If there's suffering, there's probably some Velcro between your thinking and you. Some way you're caught. So maybe I was caught by all these thoughts today, all these ideas. Because that was about a third of what I wanted to teach. So I think, you know, we could continue another hour and a half. But I think it's good to go home. And probably this is plenty of anyway. But what do you think? What should we do? We'll go home. Don't have to worry about that. But does this topic interest you anymore? That we should pick it up again next Monday? Or should we just kind of let it go and this is boring? You know, you're bored with your thoughts. And here he's telling you, look at your thoughts some more. And, you know, just rubbing it in my face. Anyway, so it's much more interesting things about thought than what I said today. This was the uninteresting part. So if I can remember it next week, should we pick it up again next week, next Monday? Okay. So in the meantime, during the week, I recommend you do some homework, some exploration, investigation. And why don't you spend the week doing two things? Whenever you can do it, whenever it makes sense, start looking at at the world of your thinking. Notice more carefully what you think about than you usually do. Notice what your relationship is to your thinking. And notice how you relate to the fact that when you're lost in thought, what your attitude toward that is. So that's, you know, look at all that. And in addition, I would strongly recommend that during this week, you go find someone. It could be a stranger on a park bench. It could be a best friend. It could be, you know, who knows? I don't know. I don't care who it is. Someone from IMC. And find someone who you can have a conversation about your relationship to thinking. How do you relate to the world of your thoughts and thinking? And maybe find out how they relate to theirs. Have a conversation. Sit down and have a really good conversation. Some of you might want to do it with real strangers, so the people you'll never see again. Because maybe then you can be a little bit freer in how you talk about it. And some of you might feel better doing it with really close friends or someone. So that's what I would recommend, because then our time together next week will be richer as we explore this further. Is that good? Thank you very much.